You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Amanda Baldwin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you are the president of Supergoop. Supergoop is a pretty awesome sunscreen company, initially launched out of San Antonio. You're based in New York. It was founded in 2007, but lately it seems like you've been making a big push around the e-commerce side. You've been with the company now for almost 3 years, is that right?
Yeah, it'll be 3 years at the end of the summer, 3 years in August, yeah.
And is that a fair description, or how would you describe Supergoop?
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, the history of the brand and its uniqueness, I think, is in the fact that it is a business that has been around since 2007. Our founder, Holly, created the brand, I really believe, was certainly way ahead of her time. So before probably a lot of the words that we're going to use today even existed in common parlance, you know, there was no Instagram, there was no Lumi, there was no Shopify, there was, you know, none of these things existed to kind of really help a business grow and to sort of create the startup culture that we live in now and the disruption. She created this business because she has a mission. We all have that mission now to change the way the world thinks about sunscreen so that there's no more skin cancer. Very simple, but hard to do. And I was brought into the business, as you said, about 3 years ago as sort of, how do we take this to the next level? And I came because I saw in this company incredible foundation in brand DNA and product. We had one shelf at Sephora, and yet it had all of the makings of what I think will make the next generation of brands. So founder-led, mission-driven, very, you know, we've layered an entire digital footprint over the top of this. And I think that it's sort of, it's not every day that you come across something like that. So what I hope to do is really create the best of both worlds. So I do come from a quote-unquote traditional background, some big beauty organizations, private equity background, and I'm really excited about taking everything that I learned in that world, but translating it to sort of what the consumer demands are from today.
Yeah. And I think I would love to go into some of that background. You were working at Estee Lauder, Dior, L. Catterton, like, you know, as an investor, as a operator in marketing. And I think it'll be really helpful to kind of get your perspective on all sides of the table and how that is, you know, factoring into how you think about Supergoop. I want to get a little bit more detail on Supergoop before we go into that. Describe a little bit, you know, before you arrived there, was the company primarily selling through retail channels? And how did that transformation towards like what it is today happen?
Yeah, I mean, so again, in 2007, so the brand actually entered into retail as we know it in about 2011. So the first business plan of this organization was actually creating sunscreen that would be available in schools. Turns out that that is a hard thing to do. Sunscreen is considered an OTC drug, so it is monographed. And at the time, there was only one state of California that allowed children to apply sunscreen in schools. It was treated like Advil. And what's been exciting to watch, and Supergoop has been a big part of this, is a lot of the laws have changed. I think we're up to 16 or 17 states now that allow sunscreen. There's actually three or four pieces of legislation out there right now that are looking to change that. Yeah, that was the origin of the brand. And then very early on, it was in kids retail, but it was in 2011 that got its big break into Sephora and Nordstrom, where it was launched in those two businesses at the same time. You know, in a lot of ways, we're, I think, living in a world in which everyone understands that it's not really a choice between direct to consumer and wholesale, that the best businesses will have both. And that there's, especially in the beauty category, where you have incredible partners like a Sephora, a Nordstrom, a Blue Mercury, Urban Outfitters as a corporation that really allows you to showcase your product and get it in front of people in a very unique way, that that's very, very powerful and completely incremental to what we might be able to do in a direct-to-consumer world. And obviously in our business, that means that our website services as much as a marketing and information vehicle as it does as a sales vehicle. And I think we're always thinking about the balance between those and the ecosystem of kind of where somebody is going to most likely purchase our product. And I think one thing that's really interesting is that we see very unique product mixes, and our business and who we appeal to varies pretty greatly depending upon the channel where we are. And I think that's a pretty unique thing to be able to do in a business, to be able to flex it in a lot of unique ways. And quite frankly, it was something that I learned a lot about when I was at LVMH, and we had a business in Dior that looked very different at Sephora than it did at Macy's and it did at Neiman Marcus. And I learned that sort of huge mega brands are created because they have that kind of flexibility.
And what year was the e-commerce or direct-to-consumer Supergoop website launched?
There was a website that was launched before I came. So there certainly was e-commerce, but it was a very small, WordPress-driven site that probably didn't look like what you would expect it to, or what it does now.
So you moved it to something like a Shopify type of thing?
Yeah, so it was not leveraging those tools. We were not buying any sort of paid media. You know, there was no marketing behind the business, which is kind of shows you how extraordinary the product is and continues to be. There was a lot of support from the press, a lot of support from the buying community. I think that people really early on understood the importance of what we're doing. And skin cancer affects 1 in 5 Americans, and 90% of the signs of aging come from the sun. So needless to say, SPF is incredibly important. It's the most important thing you can do for your skin, yet ironically is an incredibly sleepy category, because it's technically very challenging to formulate effectively in this marketplace, to deal with the regulatory, the packaging requirements, the operational complexity of what we do is pretty extraordinary. And, you know, I like to joke that it took a founder from outside the industry to have the guts to go after this and a mission that sort of rises above any of the complexities that come with it to really go after it. And I've always been a big believer in SPF. And, you know, really saw it as an underserved opportunity. That what's been exciting for us is that we're leading a change and an interest level that has started to rise among, you know, particularly the millennial consumer, who is understanding that, you know, prevention's the best medicine. So don't get those wrinkles in the first place.
Yeah. Do you have a goal and around how much you would like to see go through the direct-to-consumer channel versus the retail channel? Is it something that you ever had pushback from your retail partners at all?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, we're really about growing the pie. I think what is appealing to us with our retail partners is how quickly we're growing, and that this is an incremental category that, you know, is really about an additional opportunity for them. This is not about buy my lipstick instead of your lipstick. This is a totally different type of product. And I think what's been exciting is we've been able to be really successful partners for all of our buyers. And, you know, when we do well, when they do well, right? I mean, that's kind of the way to make those relationships work. And then when we think about the direct to consumer business, like I said, it certainly is a marketing vehicle in many ways. And I think every data point on the planet shows that if you buy in more than one place, you end up being a better and more loyal consumer. But we certainly, you know, I believe that everybody has to win in order to have a successful business. So we make sure that everybody is, you know, we're really, for us, our biggest opportunity is to get people to wear SPF. And that's not about picking between, you know, what channel they're going to buy in. It's about, you know, literally creating an entire category from scratch. And I think, you know, when Holly got into this world, and the thing that, you know, like I said, why I saw there was so much opportunity was that this is something totally new.
Yeah.
There's nobody else on the planet who thinks about it the way that we do and creates products in the way that we do and has a mission the way that we do every single day of the year. And that is where I think, you know, you get excited about the potential for this company.
We recently put up an article on the Lumi blog talking about kind of rounding up a lot of different opinions about Amazon that people mm-hmm. have shared on the podcast. And I noticed that Supergoop is there. To me, that's just another channel like your retail partners, but you've got a lot you're balancing there between your direct-to-consumer, Amazon, or other online retailers, and then your physical retailers. Mm-hmm. What does Amazon represent for you? Is it just a convenience because people are already shopping there, or how do you think about it?
So our number one most important thing is that, you know, we sell a product that protects people from the sun. And therefore, controlling our distribution, controlling the product that people actually receive at the end of the day is, you know, we have no room for error. And I think that the reality of Amazon is that if you're not selling to Amazon, somebody else will sell your product for you. And the gray market for us is just something that's not acceptable. So, you know, that is, you know, very, very important reason why we're on that platform, is to make sure that if somebody, you know, we know that over 50%, I think the stat that I've heard is 60% of searches begin on Amazon, that if somebody searches for Supergoop, that they're buying an authentic product. You know, we take our jobs very, very seriously, but we also do limit the, you know, the number of SKUs that are on there and sort of try and keep it focused on what we think is most, to your point, really convenience driven. So it's primarily products that we believe are kind of, I'm going on vacation tomorrow, I need something now. And, you know, they know the brand and they go and look for it. So, you know, it's a very focused strategy because, you know, to your point, we are balancing all these different players and we want everybody to have their piece of it. So you don't see really our newest innovations or anything like that on that platform.
And are you using Fulfillment by Amazon or are you
We sell in luxury beauty.
So explain how that works.
It's a wholesale relationship with Amazon.
Oh, I see.
Kind of how I'd explain it.
So you're selling, you're selling directly to Amazon?
Yeah, we sell it directly.
Okay, I see. And what did you call that?
It's called luxury beauty.
Oh, okay.
So it's a unique thing to the industry. Some beauty brands that you'll see will be on it. Others will not. I'm not sure I'm fully equipped to talk about all the different nuances between the different things. But for us, it's really about making sure that the product is authenticated.
Yeah, that's interesting. In my previous company, Incodi, we sold directly to Amazon, but it was in the arts and crafts market. And they had a similar type of thing, but I don't think it had a name like that, which is why it kind of I hadn't come across that. But it is something where Amazon does have basically three different types of relationships. One is what you're describing, which is you sell your product wholesale to Amazon. One is Fulfillment by Amazon, where you put your product in their warehouses and distribution centers. And the third is where you just list it on Amazon and ship it from your own warehouse. And so Each has its own kind of trade-offs. The counterfeiting issue has been really a big deal for Amazon. I feel like it's been swept under the rug by Amazon, but you know, there's huge companies like, I think Birkenstock was one of the big ones that decided to like leave the platform because of counterfeits, and that it's happening all the time. And so I guess that out of the three different relationships, you're probably like most likely to avoid counterfeiting using this the wholesale approach, because it would hurt Amazon the most.
Yeah, that's what we found. I can't speak to other categories or other businesses, but you know, and ours, like I said, is very unique. We take what we do extremely seriously. We may on the surface look like a beauty product, but at the end of the day, we're a health and wellness product, and that we are protecting somebody from something that can be potentially life-threatening ultimately, right? So, you know, you kind of can't mess around with that.
Yeah. But you have a beautiful website that is just,
you know,
really well laid out, really a lot of great education on the website. The content there is awesome. And it's also just user-friendly as a platform to go purchase your products. And I wonder, how do you get people to come over to the Supergoop website? Because you have all these other ways for people to buy what you're selling.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's always going to be everybody's going to have sort of what their preferred comfort zone is and how they purchase. So it's sort of a balancing act of this may be the place where somebody comes to get information. And then they're a Sephora VIB and, you know, they want their points and, you know, we say, have at it, right? That's certainly something that we welcome. But at the same time, obviously, you know, I think setting up a rich experience for somebody who is what we call a super groupie and really is diehard about the entire experience and wants extra benefits from shopping on our site is certainly going to go there. I think the other thing that I would point out that's very important to how we think about our direct consumer business is that, you know, we have an entire array of products that extends well beyond the typical beauty universe. So, you know, we certainly are appealing to men. We are appealing to moms who are buying a large pump for their entire family that's going to last them through the summer season. To see some interesting innovation coming out from us in the next couple of months that we think has, quite frankly, nothing to do with, you know, traditional beauty distribution. And so, you know, like I said, go back to this whole idea of we're creating a new category, we're creating a business that serves the needs of consumers across ages, across genders, you know, across lifestyles, across skin types and tones. And that's not always going to fit into traditional beauty distribution. So I think how we think about our strategy and the role of direct to consumer is very unique relative to what you might see in other beauty brands, where maybe there is a little bit more direct competition with their existing channels.
Sunscreen's been in the news lately because Hawaii and Florida are thinking mm-hmm. about banning certain ingredients that are mm-hmm. in a lot of common sunscreens out there. I also understand, and this is something that I'm not particularly well educated on, that in Europe, the regulations around sunscreen are way different than they are in the US. I would love for you to just kind of like share how that all works.
Of course. So, you know, we are incredibly ingredient focused. When Holly created this company, she literally created the first oxybenzone-free, paraben-free, what we call clean chemical formula on the market. And her motivation was, you know, if I'm going to tell people to wear sunscreen every single day, then I better cross off any excuse that they would have not to do it. And she, you know, was personally affected by breast cancer in her family and kind of was like always very hyper aware of like anything that could be potentially controversial. And so that was the first no list, was no oxybenzone, no parabens, no synthetic fragrances. And our no list now is over 100 ingredients in addition to following all the European Union regulations, which is a whole nother high hurdle. So, you know, from the very beginning and before there was conversation around clean cosmetics, we were in that space because it's the right thing to do. I think that right now there's a lot of conversation about other chemical ingredients that are up for consideration. Oxybenzone and octinoxates, the other one will be octinoxate free by the end of the year. And, you know, there's the FDA is looking at every single ingredient, and we're, you know, we actually came out with a statement a couple of weeks ago, which was, you know, the honest to goodness truth, which is like, thank goodness this is happening. And, you know, it's been 20 years since folks have looked at the monograph, evaluated it. We are very excited about the world taking this seriously because we do want people to wear this every day. And we need to make sure, you know, we don't think of ourselves just as like super goop for the sake of super goop, but this is a mission. And, you know, we just want people to wear our sunscreen. Obviously, we believe they should wear super goop, but we really think about the bigger picture here. So, you know, we welcome these changes. We think that they, you know, are going to be the right thing for the consumer. And, you know, to your point about global regulatory, yes, that is why we have a very complicated business in comparison to other companies, because the regulations are different in the EU, they're different in Canada, they're different in Australia. We have a large business in Southeast Asia. Each country there is unique. That's what we're set up to do, to be able to handle that and have the operational complexity and flexibility to be able to manage through that. But yeah, there's a lot of conversation. You know, the thing that I will definitely would want anyone listening to understand is that, you know, there are times and places for mineral sunscreens and there's times and places for chemical sunscreens. There's not a right answer. I think that it is, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of conversation out there that sort of says minerals should be the only option that's coming from certain brands in this space. And I would just say that that leaves a very important hole in the market around sunscreens that are appropriate for when you're doing a lot of active, you know, outdoor activity where your body is sweating a lot. You know, you need to be wearing a chemical formula.
I don't think people necessarily know the distinction between those two, but the mineral kind, just for people's education, is primarily based on zinc oxide, which right.
Those two ingredients, yeah. And we love them when they're, you know, they certainly have, you know, great places. We have, you know, a product called Mineral Matte Screen, which is a primer that people love. We're, you know, actively formulating more and more 100% mineral products because we think they're the right thing for people with sensitive skin, people with very young skin. And quite frankly, if somebody believes that, you know, it's mineral robust, we just want you to wear a sunscreen. So like, if that's the choice that you want to make, we are not here to try and convince people of something else. But we do think that there are going to be people who need and will want chemical formulas,
sure.
You know, because they allow your skin to breathe in a unique way. They also can be formulated into things like, we have a product called Unseen Sunscreen that's clear. You could never get zinc or titanium to be clear. In fact, if you see something that says clear mineral, that means that the mineral actives are not protecting you. So there's no such thing as a clear mineral formula. So,
right.
And people love Unseen Sunscreen. And, you know, if that's what they want to wear every day, we're going to give it to them in the cleanest way possible. You know, and I think the other thing that goes undiscussed a lot is that, you know, when you talk about the percentage of a formula that is actually the active ingredients in a sunscreen versus everything else, it's about 10%. So there's a lot of formulas that are, you know, mineral, but have a lot of junk in the other 90%. We think about every single ingredient. So, you know, if that's the choices that you want to make, then, you know, read the rest of the label is what I would tell people.
Yeah. So the zinc and titanium based ones tend to like leave a white residue, but they're maybe like more natural, but they're less waterproof or other types of properties, or less, can't be transparent. Those are the trade-offs between different things.
Titanium and zinc are made in a lab too. So I think that there's a lot of misinformation that somehow that's more natural. It just doesn't make sense, but people certainly associate that with those two ingredients. The reason that we have sort of formulated and reformulated mineral products is to get rid of that white cast. So what we've been able to achieve is formulas that actually feel good on the skin. That was the early insight behind what we do, is that, you know, sunscreen is only good if you wear it. And so getting mineral formulas to a place where they're not thick and pasty, where they spread well on the skin. So, you know, the other issue to your point is they can sometimes not spread well. They don't sink in well. You end up in a situation where the mineral actives are not stabilized effectively. And so they all sink to the bottom, and you spray on what looks like clear mineral formula. And guess what? It's just water, or the rest of the formula. It's not actually protecting you. So there's a lot of, you know, if your mission at the end of the day is to protect people from skin cancer, the efficacy of the sunscreen is very, very important. And you got to think through not just the ingredients, but how they're connected together, how they apply on the skin, the water resistance, all those things. And, you know, I think, again, that's something that sort of goes undiscussed in a lot of these conversations, is like, is it actually working at the end of the day? And we're the only brand that actually, we post our efficacy results on our site. You can go see them.
Wow. That's cool.
And there's a lot of, you know, if you Google mineral sunscreens gone bad, there's a lot of situations where they don't stabilize very well. So there's a lot of complicated chemistry in this, which is, you know, I think this is all we do all day. So, you know, I think our ability to deliver products that feel good on the skin, clean ingredients, and work, and then make it fun while we're at it, so you actually want to put it on instead of run screaming in the other direction, which is what a lot of people typically do when you hear the word sunscreen. That's what we're all about.
And the other concern, and what's going on with Hawaii and Florida, is that some of the ingredients that are on the no list for super goop, like the ones you mentioned, like oxybenzone and octinoxate, seem to be linked to like issues with coral reefs. And so, you know, something that I was reading, and I think it was on Vox, had an article about this. They were talking about how the FDA hasn't been as willing to open up new ingredients that can be used in formulas. Is that different in the U.S. than it is in Europe or other places?
Yeah, there's more sunscreen actives available for use in the EU, Japan, and Korea. You see some other ingredients, and, you know, like I said, the ingredients that are acceptable for use have been the same in this country for the last 20 years. You know, we think there's certainly opportunity to add to that, because having other ingredients that are sort of declared as safe to use only increases our ability to create exciting and effective products. And I do think you have to have both, because, again, you know, the best sunscreen is the one that you're going to use. And so how you can formulate and what your flexibility is around formulating, you know, to what I was saying, like we're known for innovation. We're known for a mousse, for a clear sunscreen, for a setting spray, things that like require flexibility and ingredients in order to like make them work. And, you know, that's really important too, right? I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, where we started this conversation, that this is, you know, this is a health and wellness issue. And it's really important to make sure that we don't lose sight of that while, you know, but I think there's a lot of space. You know, we're very much supportive of, like I said, all of these changes to the conversation around ingredients, because we think that they're certainly are reasons. And, you know, like I said, we were the first ones who said no to oxybenzone, literally the first. So, you know, we welcome those changes. And, you know, our, just to give you a sense, our everyday formula, which is the first formula and still one of our top sellers, it's on its eighth iteration now because we learn something new. Like for us, a formula is never finished. We learn something new about ingredients, about how to formulate effectively, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll go back and redo it. So, you know, we're not afraid of that.
When you redo the formula, does that become a new product or do you update the formula of the same product?
We'll update the formula, you know.
How do you communicate that with people?
You know, it depends on the situation. Most of the time we just do it because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
It's just that simple.
But it's something that for me, coming from more of a software development background, and it's like interesting because you can do that easily if you're, you know, making a website or an app or yeah. something. You can just say like, oh, this is the, you know, 1.1 version of this. And there are products out there. Soylent comes to mind, which is an interesting product that had versioning like that. I would love to see that more in all kinds of other products where it's sort of expected that there's iterative improvements, but then obviously you have to deal with the fact that it's a physical thing.
There's inventory, there's all sorts of things, right? So we, you know, like I said, that's what makes us, I think, uniquely capable to handle all of this is that we don't know anything else. And so we're set up to manage through all of that stuff. But it's certainly harder than just pushing a button. The thing that I love about leading this organization is that we have a mission. And, you know, when you have a mission, there's always a true north. And you can always go back to that and, you know, recalibrate off of it. And usually the answer is pretty obvious.
Let's go into some of your background before Supergoop. I would love to hear a little bit about, you know, your background. The thing that you were doing just before was with Al Catterton at a company called Strivectin. Can you talk a little bit about that company? We haven't really touched on private equity on the podcast before.
Yeah, I mean, Al Catterton is an incredible organization. It's the largest consumer private equity fund out there with global reach and reach across pretty broad scale of organizations. So as a growth fund, as well as a buyout fund, plays in the real estate space. And like I said, plays across the globe. So really, really unique perspective on the industry and one of the very early investors in consumer and early sort of sector-specific investors. You know, and I've been around the private equity space since before I went to business school. I did my first job out of college was a couple of years as an investment banker, and then I got into private equity investing and sort of always thought about the world as an investor in one shape or another. And still, you know, quite frankly, when I decided to come to Supergoop, I put on my investor hat because ultimately when you're investing your career and your time behind something, there's no bigger capital, as I'm sure you can appreciate. So I think that there's, you know, the perspective of, you know, how do you create equity value at the end of the day is really what you bring to the table when you have an investor mindset. And I think it's certainly something that was valuable in coming into this company was really thinking, you know, about how do you create a business that has this, you know, take this incredible mission and put behind it a business that is scalable and valuable, because that's actually ultimately how you succeed in that mission, is that you're able to operationalize something that is profitable and self-sustaining and all those kinds of things. And that's how we get it, you know, changing the world. So I think that was probably I am told was an important part of the equation in my sitting in this seat. I think that there are so many fascinating things that are happening in the consumer space today and the investing space and the intermingling of the two and who's interested in the consumer world and at what scale the investments are happening, what scale the M&A is happening at. I mean, it's changed a lot, quite frankly, since I was, you know, I was consumer investor at Apax and kind of the types of businesses that we were seeing then versus what's happening in the ecosystem today in the consumer space, I think is really, really fascinating. And I think there's a whole new crop of consumer investors that have come in to support this early stage world that's starting to happen, and everything from VC to early stage consumer. And I draw distinctions between those two points of view. It's really exciting. I mean, quite frankly, I never totally knew what fun it would be when I chose this career path, but I'm loving it.
You mentioned having a unique perspective of being able to see the different people's perspective around the table. Can you paint that picture a little bit, just kind of like a quick way to describe how the private equity investor versus like a VC investor versus, you know, an operator versus, I don't know, who else in your mind kind of fits around that table?
Yeah, I mean, I think that ultimately when you're sitting in my shoes, you need to understand, you know, everybody's perspective and what everybody wants out of a business in order to lead it successfully. And I think and figure out those points of alignment, and also figure out sort of where those unique aspects are. And I think that that goes from your investor base, your founders, every individual on the team. And I think that it's something that I sort of over time have grown to understand that I actually love. You know, I started in marketing when I was at Clinique, and I saw the power very early on of understanding humans and understanding people and understanding their perspectives was the secret to success, and that I needed to change my language, even as a marketer, to talk to the creative department, to talk to the finance department, to talk to the production people, to talk to product development, that I literally couldn't use the same language, even if I was actually trying to say the same thing. And I think that that's just in my role today has just expanded to include a whole host of additional people that are supporting this business as we grow, right? So it's the same different departments and different individuals that are part of the operational side, but you add into that mix, like we were talking about, your investors, you know, making sure that, you know, I understand. And, you know, because I came from that side of the world, I certainly understand, you know, what their point of view is and value that as we think through things. Also really consider myself very lucky that I've been given the opportunity to take a business and work with founders to kind of create that vision for Holly, and, you know, kind of really understand what she wants out of the business and what her vision is. So I really believe that that is the number one most important thing you can do as a leader, is think about who's around the table and make sure, quite frankly, that around the table are all the right voices. When I think about building a team, I want a lot of different perspectives that are going to come at a problem from a different angle. And it's by the conversation, the dialogue that happens between all of that, that actually, I think, gets you to the right answer.
You said that you were putting your investor hat on when you decided to join Supergoop. Mm-hmm. If you were to abstract that for anyone who's making a big career change in their life, what is it that you think of when you think of putting your investor hat on? What are the questions that you were asking yourself that maybe other people could ask themselves if they're studying, like joining a company?
It's a great question. You know, I think that ultimately I was thinking about what was the potential of this business? What could I see in it in those early days that would lead me to believe that this business has the potential to be, you know, a $1 billion company? And I really fundamentally believe that, if not more, you know, and kind of be on a global scale. And I think I was looking a lot for things that I had seen and been around when I was at Dior and LVMH, when I was at Lauder and Clinique. You know, those were, you know, multi-billion-dollar global companies. And I think the benefit of having learned there and learned from some of the best brands and people in the industry was that I understood what it could look like and what you needed to have in place and what made for true brand DNA, what made for true product expertise. And those you can never go back and create. You either have them or you don't. And then also really thinking a lot about, you know, the macro analysis of where is the industry going, and does this brand have the potential to go where it's going? I think when you try and fight the macro trends, it's very hard to win. And I like to win. So, you know, I was also thinking a lot about that. So what was unique to this business, and how was this business uniquely positioned to succeed? And then I think the other thing that you think about as an investor is, you know, what's your role and what's your value added to it? And are you the right person and are you the right firm to help drive the business forward? And so, you know, I was thinking a lot about what do I know and understand, and am I the right match to, you know, to help this all come to fruition? And, you know, I think when you're going through an interview process and you're taking a job, especially as you get a little bit further on in your career, you know, I'm a big believer it's all about matchmaking and that you have to be able to bring as much to the table as you're going to get out of it. And you have to be the right person for the job, you know, and that's really what it ultimately comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like on the first part of your description, it's kind of hard for someone who hasn't had, you know, 10 years of experience in the beauty space to kind of make that same analysis. I wonder, is there a way to do that in more abstract fashion? Where would you recommend that anyone who's like maybe joining a startup in the direct to consumer space study the market somehow? Like, what would be the tools or things that you would recommend?
Here's a couple of things I'd say. First of all, I think what you need to achieve early in your career, very different than, you know, I was already, I don't know, 15 years out of college or whatever when I took this job, a little bit more. So I had a lot of years under my belt and I learned a lot. I think in an early career, I really believe in test, learn, iterate. So just kind of start learning, learn from the best and the brightest that you possibly can. Don't underestimate the power of going to a big company where there is, you know, a huge organization that you can kind of soak up a lot around you. I think sometimes that goes underutilized, you know, so I started at, you know, big organizations that kind of taught me how it was done. And every time I would kind of lift up my head, I'd say, what do I love about my job? What could I maybe leave? And kind of iterate from there. And those were much, they're a little bit shorter stints, 3-4 years. I wasn't making what I felt was a career bet in the way that I felt that I was doing here. I was leaving a job and a firm that I loved to take a chance on a really, you know, high potential but very small company. And that's a big bet when you're, you know, and I was also becoming a president. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you are leading an organization, the buck stops with you. So, you know, you're not just there to learn, but you're there to deliver results. And so, you know, the calculus at that stage in your career is also very different. So, but I would say, you know, if you're going to go to an organization, do your homework. You know, I think one thing I have learned over the years is that you and you alone cannot change the trajectory of an organization. It takes everybody pulling in the same direction. And so making sure that you're putting yourself in a place where you're set up for success is really important. And I think being set up for success has a lot to do with kind of what's the potential of the organization as a whole and thinking about that from a very analytical point of view, not just, you know, do I think it's cool or not, right? It's like, is there a sound business model behind this? What do I think of the leadership? What are the, you know, what's the momentum behind the company? And, you know, ultimately you have to believe. I mean, you work too hard and too many hours in this world not to believe in what you're doing.
Outside of Holly, were there people around the table at Supergoop that you were really excited to work with and or people that you were able to bring on over the past couple of years that really kind of created that leadership that made you excited to work there?
Yeah, I mean, I was very, you know, lucky. I got to build a team of extraordinary people. And it's certainly the thing that I'm the most proud and excited by is the fact that we have just people who are just triple A plus players doing what they do every day. And, you know, it's the most important thing I think about every day is, do we have the right people in the right jobs and are they having the time of their lives? I mean, if you get that right, the rest takes care of itself. Because like I said, you cannot do it alone, especially not in my from my perspective, some days I'm like, I don't know that I do anything. I'm 100% reliant on everybody else. And obviously I want to be a coach. I want to be a sounding board, but I, you know, that's all I can be at the end of the day. And so you better have the best possible people who are pulling it out with you.
I always think of like Ocean's 11. I've watched that movie so many times where it's, you're putting together a team and you're trying to create an environment that where people have complementary skills and are all, like you said, you know, triple A players. Describe some of the challenges or proud moments that you have. If there's any specific people that come to mind that you were able to bring together, or how did you build that team? Like, what was that process like?
You know, it was exciting and extremely hard. I think it's one of the things that, you know, is certainly the most emotional, I would say, about being is, you know, is that you are trying to really learn about people, understand them, make sure that you have set them up for success. And, you know, when it, and I'll be the first to say, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you end up with the wrong match. And, you know, I really believe that it's about a match. You know, it's just like you put them in the wrong job. And I look at it as, I think I take it very seriously because I think, you know, ultimately I have, you know, they're real, you know, people have their lives and their livelihood. And, you know, I would say I've been through some certainly very emotionally challenging times as I've sort of realized like, oh my gosh, we made a mistake. And that's a horrible feeling. And the only thing that I can say to if anybody's in a similar situation is, the best thing you can do is to fix it. And it's not just for the business, but it's actually for you and for the person in that job. And I've been through it enough now to know that it's always better on the other side, but getting through it is usually pretty terrible.
Is there something that you would advise like people who are going through on the, maybe on the founder side or on the leadership side when they do like run into those types of situations?
I'll give the advice that was given to me that I don't always take, which is if you even have the thought, do it sooner, that you never sort of go back and change your mind. That was given to me by another founder when I was struggling with this really early on. And I always try and channel her and remember that she's right. And then usually probably take too long. But
well, it's hard. Yeah, because like you said, the emotions are involved and it's real people.
Yeah, it's not easy. But at the end of the day, I think it is a very valuable piece of advice.
When you think about Supergoop, you know, going forward, you have this big mission. You're trying to prevent skin cancer. What are the things that are kind of on your roadmap for the next however many years that you're really looking forward to or excited about?
So I, as I said, this company has always been great at product. I'm a total product junkie. I'm very excited about the things that we're working on in our pipeline and the continued innovation of this company. I think, you know, even in a couple of weeks, starting next week, you're going to see some crazy stuff coming from us. That's just really exciting. And I think our point of view is if it's done before, then why bother? So I'm really excited about the innovation. I'm very excited to turn the flip side on the conversation we were just having about people, you know, to all the positive things that have happened and the fact that, you know, people have said to me that this is the best job that they've ever had. And I'm excited for the future of what people are learning, of kind of giving people a once in a lifetime career opportunity and getting more people into the Supergoop family as we grow. And, you know, like we just have an incredible culture. We have an incredible brand. I mean, we're selling sunshine for a living, right? So, you know, we have a lot of fun. And I think at the end of the day, that's awesome. And, you know, I really feel very lucky to get up every day and think that we are making the world a better place. And I think that it's a very rare gift to be able to do that and also create a great business. And I do think that that's certainly what I hope to see more and more in this world is businesses that kind of take both sides of the equation, because I think that's how we're going to create real change.
Is there anything we forgot to talk about? I feel like we've covered a lot.
No, I think, you know, the only thing I would say is that, you know, for anyone listening, it's, you know, I certainly have a lot of respect and understanding for what it means to build a business. And, you know, I certainly a lot of empathy for the ups and downs of everything that comes with it. But I, you know, I think at the end of the day, sort of loving what you do and following your heart is really the only thing that matters. So maybe that's a nice parting thought.
So for people who are planning for their summer and or are in places that are already sunny like we are here in Los Angeles, people can go to supergoop.com or all of their retailers, their preferred places probably carry it. So is there anything else you want to point people to?
You can find us in all the Sephora's, probably the other most easily accessible place for people to go.
Are there any big roles or, you know, positions that are available at Supergoop that you're looking to hire for?
Not right now. What I would say, though, is that I always love meeting talent, and I have a lot of really great stories of people that we've met, and then a year later, all of a sudden, it's bingo. So I definitely believe in, you know, building relationships that pay out, maybe not immediately, but you kind of all of a sudden hits you over the head. So
Cool. If people want to reach out to you, what's the best way to do that?
AmandaB@supergoop.com.
Wow. I hope you get some emails. That's great.
Hey, you know.
Cool.
Why not?
All right. Well, thank you so much, Amanda. This was really fascinating. And I love what you're doing with Supergoop. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? Or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to? Send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.